have seen the Disney Pixar film Inside Out. Okay, that's a lot of you. In case you don't know, and you should watch it, it's a really great film. It follows a tween girl named Riley as her family moves across the country and as she faces the many emotions that come with such a move. But the real stars of the show are actually Riley's emotions. Five characters, joy, sadness, fear, disgust, and anger, who are depicted as operating a control center in her brain. Now, the central conflict of Inside Out is between joy and sadness. Joy doesn't think there's any place for sadness in Riley's life, and then many misadventures ensue until finally, spoiler, Joy realizes that sadness actually has a role to play after all. Now, I know I have, but have you ever wondered what a version of Inside Out based on your brain would look like? Because as I started thinking about anger for this sermon, I realized that the Inside Out version of my brain would feature all of my emotions trying to stuff anger in a closet and never let it out. And I can see all of my Enneagram ones in the audience like nodding along. I grew up experiencing anger, both my own anger and the anger that I experienced from others, as something that was unpredictable and frightening, and also as something that I needed to control. So for my internal life, this meant squashing anger down whenever it emerged. And for my relational life, this meant doing my best to avoid anger from other people. And when I couldn't avoid it, working really hard to placate that anger and make it go away. I'm guessing that my experiences probably resonate with at least some of you, but I do wonder, what have your own experiences with anger been like? How have you experienced your own anger? Maybe anger for you, it arises from fear, or it emerges as a way to exert control. Maybe you've been taught to hide your anger, that it's not an appropriate emotion, or maybe on the opposite side, you've been socialized to think that anger is the only appropriate emotion that you can show. Maybe you struggle with a quick temper. Maybe you actually have a healthy relationship with your anger, so I'm sure that's some of you. And then we also experience anger in a lot of different ways, so think about how you've experienced anger. If you experienced anger as something that's frightening or harmful, something that you think you deserve, maybe you experienced anger more positively as the prompt to change something about your actions or yourself. And I will say at this point in my introduction, you might be wondering, isn't this supposed to be about God's anger? Yes, we're going to be talking about God's anger, but I do think that probably more than any other emotion, our experience of anger shapes how we think about God's anger. And while our experiences of anger can help us understand God's anger, our experiences of anger can also lead us to create a distorted picture of who God is. So on the positive side of understanding God's anger, we are created in the image of God. And perhaps surprisingly sometimes, this means that our emotions are also in the image of God. So we experience anger because we're created in the image of a God who also experiences anger. Now, we do want to be careful because God's anger is not the same as human anger. We are using limited human terms to describe the emotions of an entirely different sort of being. But even with this caution, I do think that we can at least begin to understand God's anger in large part because we too experience anger. But on the more negative side of how our own experiences with anger impact our view of God, especially if you've experienced anger as frightening or damaging, it can be really hard to wrap our minds around a God who is compassionate, as Kevin reminded us last week, but also sometimes angry. And so we might take a variety of approaches to try to resolve this tension. We might totally reject the idea that God can be angry. And the 14th century English mystic, Julian of Norwich, does exactly this. She writes in her treatise on her mystical visions, which is appropriately called The Revelation of Divine Love, she asserts that there cannot possibly be anger in God. because God is wholly loving. Now, on the other hand, we might construct a picture of a God who is primarily vengeful. And I think this is a pretty popular depiction of at least God from the Old Testament. I ran across a Far Side cartoon in preparing for this sermon that depicts God, right, you know, beard, white hair, all of that, sitting at a computer in heaven, and his fingers hovering over the keyboard, and there's a button on that keyboard that's labeled smite, right? So he's just waiting to press that smite button. Yeah, if you Google God smite button, you'll find it. But this is not a God who invites relationship. And if this is your idea of God, you might live in fear of God, or you might end up just rejecting God altogether. Or if you don't reject God altogether, but you still have this view of the Old Testament God especially as angry and vengeful, you might fall into one of the oldest heresies of the church and separate the God of the Old Testament from the God of the New Testament, seeing the God of the Old Testament as vengeful and sort of stuck in his ways and not actually God, but the God of the New Testament, as we see in the person of Jesus, as loving and kind. Or maybe, and I'm guessing that this describes many of you in the room, just like it also describes me, maybe we just struggle to understand how a loving God can also experience anger. How do we reconcile a God who shows anger, like he does in that story of the Israelites who make the golden calf? How do we reconcile that angry God with the love that Jesus shows on the cross when he dies for all of humanity? Now, just to manage expectations tonight, I doubt that I'm going to fully resolve this struggle for any of you. Even after spending hours this week grappling with it, I am still unsettled in some ways by God's anger, even if I think I understand a little better how to see God's anger in relation to God's love. But what I really hope to offer you tonight, to offer us tonight, as we look at these passages in Exodus and Mark, is this. We don't have to choose between an angry God and a loving God. God's anger and God's love are not in opposition to each other. Yes, God is angry at sin and evil, at idolatry and injustice. He's angry, though, because these things hurt us and hurt our relationship with God. God's anger flows from the deeper truth of God's love for us. God's anger is slow, offering ample time for us to return to God. God's anger never outweighs God's compassion for all that he has made. So with that in mind, let's dive into these two passages in Exodus and Mark in order to start to understand what makes God angry and why these things make God angry. So we, of course, could spend a lot of time listing out the specific things that make God angry, but just for the sake of simplicity for this sermon, I'm going to talk about two categories that anger God: idolatry and injustice. Now, Jesus teaches us, as you remember, that the core of the law and the prophets is to love God with all our heart and soul and mind and strength, and to love our neighbors as ourselves, right? You can all quote this to me. The opposite of those two things is idolatry, right? To love something other than God, and injustice, which is to treat our neighbors badly. So again, I'm just going to speak really broadly about both idolatry and injustice. And when we start with that passage in Exodus 32 that you heard read just a little bit earlier, we can immediately see that God becomes angry because of idolatry. This is it's really clear in the text that this is what makes God angry. And not only does it make him angry because the Israelites are creating this golden calf to worship, but they have made this idol just weeks after receiving the Ten Commandments from God. And the timeline is not 100% clear, but we're talking like weeks to months after God has led them out of Egypt and rescued them from slavery. They have just promised, the Israelites have just promised to God that they will be his covenant people. And then Moses is up on the mountain for a little bit longer than they're comfortable with, and they're like, well, I guess we're just going to make ourselves an idol. The really crazy thing about this too is that if you go back a couple of chapters earlier in Exodus, God even shows himself, not just to Moses and Aaron, but also 70 of the elders of Israel. So these people have literally seen God, and yet they still decide that an idol is the way to go. So in all of that context, I think we can really clearly see that your idolatry is not just as simple as creating an idol to worship, but it is just this deliberate and really anger-provoking, right? Turn away from the God who has just rescued them. And while in this passage, God's anger seems primarily directed at the Israelites' idolatry, I want to also point out that I think injustice also plays a role here. Because by rejecting God, the Israelites are also rejecting the laws that God, again, just weeks earlier, had given them. And those laws included not just the Ten Commandments, but also laws that mandate, among other things, the fair treatment of slaves, of widows and orphans, and of the foreigners living amongst them. And we see this connection between idolatry and injustice over and over in the Old Testament. When the prophets say what Israel has done to anger God, they consistently point both to idolatry, adopting foreign gods, and to injustice in how the powerful treat the powerless. So when the Israelites break their relationship with God by creating the golden calf, that brokenness invades their relationships with others as well. Just as our love of God is expressed in our love of others, a rejection of God can pave the way to our mistreatment of others. And then if we flip over to Mark 3, we're going up a little bit in time in our Bibles, we can see a similar connection between idolatry and injustice in the story of Jesus healing a man on the Sabbath. Although I think the idolatry isn't immediately obvious, because after all, the story is set in a synagogue where people are gathered to worship God. But as Jesus clearly knows in this story, some of those people are there not to worship God, but to trap Jesus in a violation of the Jewish law. So we need to pay attention to the question that Jesus asks, because he asks those gathered in the temple after he makes this man with a withered hand stand up. Jesus says, which is lawful on the Sabbath? To do good or to do evil? To save life or to kill? Jesus is asking if those seeking to trap him care more about God, the God who they well know saves, does good, and saves life. Do they care more about this God, or do they care about the law? The law is meant to guide and protect a relationship with God. But what Jesus is revealing is that the Pharisees too often worship the law rather than the God to whom the law points. So we can see that this idolatry, this worshiping something other than God, begins to disrupt a relationship with God. And just as we saw with idolatry and injustice connected in the Exodus story, we see the same connection here in Mark 3. The Pharisees would rather see this man with the withered hand continue to suffer than to see him healed on the Sabbath. Which means that in their insistence on the law, they actually exclude this man from the healing and restoration that are integral parts of God's Sabbath rest. So as we outline these events, I hope we're already beginning to see the answer to my next question. But we should also ask, why do these things make God angry? Because we know that God's anger differs from human anger. God's anger is not arbitrary or unpredictable. Unlike us, God never gets hangry. He doesn't get hormonal. He doesn't just wake up on the wrong side of the bed one day. But as we think about these two narratives that we've just discussed, I think we're brought back to this idea of God's anger as flowing from God's love. Because idolatry and injustice make God angry precisely because they cause harm to ourselves and to those around us. As human beings, we are created to be in relationship with God. And God is angry because when that relationship breaks, we are choosing to set ourselves on a path towards evil and death rather than life and salvation. And I would venture to guess that most of us have probably felt a similar form of anger when we see someone we love making self-destructive choices. And even more understandable, perhaps, is God's anger at injustice. I imagine we've all felt this anger on our own behalf, maybe sometimes unfairly, but sometimes rightly, right? And I think we've probably all felt it on behalf of others as well, because injustice causes harm, and sometimes overwhelming harm, to the neighbors whom Jesus calls us to love. And more, if you're like me, you tend to be angrier when the injustice happens to someone you know and love, which is a reaction I think that points us to the connection between our anger over these injustices and our love for the person who has been harmed. Now, obviously, God's judgments about justice and injustice are far more accurate than ours, and God can't actually love everyone in a way that we as mere humans can't. But I think that even as we acknowledge that God is not the same as humans, our own experience of anger helps us to understand why idolatry and injustice make God angry, and to understand how that anger is connected to God's love and compassion. I've got one more question about this, because even if we can understand why God is angry, we might still ask, why does God show us this anger? Human anger can be frightening enough. God's anger is terrifying. I learned from Mother Karen the idea of like inside words and outside words, right? You have the things that you think that you keep here, right? And then the things that are okay to express to other people. And God certainly has the power to fully control how he expresses his anger. So why does God so openly display an emotion that can be so difficult for us to reconcile with the reality that God not only loves, but is love? And I think there's probably many possible answers to this question, but what I want to suggest here is that without God's anger, we might not fully understand the damage caused by idolatry and injustice. God shows us his anger because otherwise we might remain blind to the harm that's caused when we fail to love God and love our neighbor. I find this especially helpful in thinking about our passage in Mark 3. This is the only time in all of the Gospels that Jesus is explicitly described as angry. Now, obviously, there's the cleansing of the temple where we see Jesus exhibiting anger, but this is the only place where the actual Greek word for being angry is used of Jesus. And I think this should make us take extra notice, because Jesus' anger at the Pharisees tells us that it's not a minor, no big deal kind of mistake to worship the law instead of the lawgiver. It's an error that breaks the life-giving relationship with God and spills over into causing harm to others. And I think that Jesus is especially angry here because the Pharisees should have known better. Unlike people like the tax collectors or the prostitutes who really don't have a relationship with God, the Pharisees believe that in following the law, they are maintaining and protecting a relationship with God. But what they don't notice is that this is coming at the expense of those who are already suffering. And this should put them into the fact that they're substituting a creation for the Creator. And so I think that part of why God allows us to see his anger so that we can just better understand the severity of sin and evil, idolatry and injustice. And God allows us to see his anger so that we can also better understand the depth of his love and mercy and compassion. Because even though our actions make God angry, even though the day of God's wrath will come when God once and for all destroys sin and evil and death, God's love is steadfast and endures forever, renewing and resurrecting what has been damaged by sin and evil. So, how does this account of God's anger in relation to God's love applied to our lives? How does it help us relate to our own anger and then relate to God? And I'll start with thinking about how it helps us relate to our own anger. Because if we affirm that anger is an emotion that even God experiences, then we can stop trying to stuff our anger into a closet in our brains, right? If it is okay for God to feel angry, then surely it's also okay for us to feel angry. Now, of course, as I frequently remind my children, being angry is fine, but we have to be careful about our actions when we're angry. Feeling anger is one thing, biting your sister is another. Paul reminds us, of course, in Ephesians, not to sin in our anger, and we certainly need this reminder. But also, anger can be an energizing emotion. Anger can sometimes give us the push that we need to work towards justice. So can we turn our anger over injustice into action to be God's ambassadors of justice in the world? Sometimes, especially in really charged political moments, not that we know anything about that right now, right? People can play off our fears and our anger in order to manipulate us. So even with righteous anger, you want to be wise and discerning. But when you feel angry about the harm that people experience, consider how you can take the energy that comes from that anger and join in God's work of renewal that is happening all around us. And if understanding God's anger can help us have a healthier understanding of our own anger, I think that understanding God's anger can also help us better relate to God. And for me, at least, this view of God's anger as deeply connected to God's love is helpful. And not because we need to interpret God's actions, no matter how baffling, as loving, but because I can understand being angry at the things that cause harm to our loved ones, even when it's that loved one who is bringing harm upon themselves. So God's anger becomes relatable rather than frightening, and predictable rather than capricious. And I've certainly experienced God as patient and as gentle, even when dealing with sin and its effects in my life. So the idea of an angry God still makes me uncomfortable. But I will say, the more that I can distance myself from the idea of God just waiting to hit that smite button, and the more I can immerse myself in God's love, the more I'm able to accept God's anger at the things that hurt me, even when those things are embedded in my own heart. And as we learn to hold together God's anger and God's love, I think we have to end with Jesus. But first, a quick detour back to Moses. In the story of the golden calf, I want you to notice the role that Moses plays. So God says in verses 9 and 10 about the Israelites, "I have seen these people, and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone, so that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them." And when Moses hears that, what Moses does is he enters into a dialogue with God. Now, this is not the right time for a discussion about whether God can change his mind, unless you have like 2 more hours. But I'm not even sure that that's the right question in this passage. Because what I see here is that God is inviting Moses into a dialogue where what Moses says represents God's love and mercy. "Why should God be angry?" Moses asks. "Shouldn't God honor the promises that he made to Abraham and Isaac and Israel?" And because God is slow to anger and rich in love, God does relent and he does not destroy the Israelites. And what I really want to emphasize here is that Moses isn't placating God or talking God down, as we might when we're faced with anger. Instead, Moses is voicing the character of God, externalizing a dialogue that is taking place within God himself. Because in speaking this way to God, Moses points us towards the one who will reconcile us once and for all to God, who is Jesus Christ. Moses may voice God's own character, but Jesus is himself fully God. So ultimately, God steps between us and God's righteous anger. God takes sin and evil and death into himself in the person of Jesus in order to destroy them once and for all. And so because of Jesus, we do not need to be afraid of God's anger when it's expressed in the ultimate destruction of sin and evil and death. Friends, what I hope I've reminded you of tonight is that God is merciful and compassionate, slow to anger and rich in love. God's anger at the things that harm us only underscore his love for us. Because through the work of Jesus, and through Jesus' death and resurrection and ascension, God saves us from the final expression of his anger when he destroys sin and evil and death. And so we don't need to choose between a wrathful God and a loving God. We can begin to hold those two together and see that God is abidingly loving and faithful and merciful and compassionate, even as he is angry at those things.